So, sorry, I don't have my clock on. Okay. So, you know, we already have sort of powerful tools. So, as an example, about a week ago, a fellow David Vincent sent me a picture of a knot. The picture here is in blue, and told me he couldn't identify it. He couldn't tell which one it is. And I'm actually being a bit. He said something else. He said, "Here is a knot that's not in the tables. The world is collapsing." Okay. So I put it on my notebook and labeled the strands 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 as I should. Then each crossing becomes an X symbol. So like this crossing is a 6, 14, 7, 13. So it's X 6, 14, 7, 13, and I kept the structure more or less the same, just so that it would be easy to tell. And then I defined K1 to be this knot. You'll have to believe me that I typed it right. And then I said, let's compute its Jones polynomial. So let's compute J of K1. And again, the computer takes almost no time, and that's the answer. And then again, I have a computer, and I have a table of all knots. So I tell the computer, select from among all knots with up to 8 crossings. This one has 8 crossings, so I knew I would have to find it within the list of knots with 8 crossings, at most 8 crossings, a knot for which whose Jones polynomial, whose J, as I've computed, is equal to J1, the Jones polynomial of K1. So all of this took about 5 minutes, and the run time is a few seconds because it's only up to 8. And the conclusion is that this is not 8:14. So if you don't believe me, you now can look at the knot table. So let me enter 8:14 in the search box. And this is it. And you have to compare with Vincent's drawing with the drawing shown here, and in fact it's not entirely obvious. I mean, you have to move things a bit until it's clear. The main thing, I think, is if that strand wasn't here, then, right, if this strand wasn't here, then this would be a kink, and you would be able to undo it. So you try to undo it, but as a result, it introduces a kink up here. And that's what you get here. So the kind of lower thing became untangled, but the upper thing got kinked. And then they're the same. Other than that, they're the same. So I don't know, just you actually already have some tools.
Okay. It's interesting that it takes a human at the end to still... verify.
Oh, there are actually also programs to do Rademeister moves, but we didn't do any of them, so I have to rely on it. And it's sufficiently small, but you're right. Okay? Okay. 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 The next thing is, well, this program is actually ridiculously slow. It's very clean and elegant, but you can do way better. And I want to explain a little bit about the way better program, because it's yet another advertisement for why one should study tangles. And I'm going to study tangles a lot. Okay? So here is the idea. The idea is, you have a complicated knot, and you want to compute its Jones polynomial, you do it, well, let me do first iteration and then second iteration. So first iteration, and if the idea is you have a complicated knot, I'm not bothering to draw it with over and under, I'm just drawing it as a complicated mess. It has 20 crossings. I don't know, I'm estimating it as more like 30, but it doesn't matter. Let's pretend it's 30 crossings. I want to compute its Jones polynomial. It's going to take about time 2 to the 30. Right? Because each crossing will be resolved into a 0 smoothing and a 1 smoothing. So there are 2 to the 30 overall resolutions. That's the time it will take. This is a large number. Right? And then for each one of these, you have to do something which is relatively mild. But still, 2 to the 30 is a large number. But now the idea is, let's cut this knot in half and compute whatever you get at the top. So at the top you have a tangle. So compute the invariant of the top, compute the invariant of the bottom, and pair them. Okay, and somehow figure out how they pair. So computing the invariant of the top should take 2 to the 15. Right, I cut it in half. Computing the invariant at the bottom should take another 2 to the 15. 2 to the 15 plus 2 to the 15 is 2 to the 16. But then I have to add to it the cost of pairing. Okay? So the question is, what's the cost of pairing? Okay? But things look good because I've shrunk from 2 to the 30 to 2 to the 16. But then I can do even better. I mean, if I need to do the thing at the invariant of the thing at the bottom, again I can cut it in half. Okay? And if I cut it in half, I just get 2 to the 7 on each side, 2 to the 8, let's be. So 2 to the 7 on each side is much less than 2 to the 15 overall for that half. Again, but there is a cost to the pairing. Okay? So this general methodology is called divide and conquer, for obvious reasons. And it works if the cost of pairing is relatively cheap. So let's estimate the cost of pairing. The cost of pairing is, first thing I need to know, what is the dimension of the output? So if I have an output from here, I need to know in how big a space does it live. So I need to know what is the dimension, or more precisely, what is the rank, right? Dimension is over a field, and this is over some ring of polynomials. So I need to know what is the rank of the temporary Lie algebra. So claim the rank of the temporary Lie algebra with n strands is, I don't know, let's figure it out. Okay? So if n is equal to 1, there's only one thing I can do. If n is equal to 2, there are two things I can do. This and that. If n is equal to 3, so I think there are, let's see, what can I do? So let's start from this point. My points will be like that. And then my options are, I can connect this one to the left, and then there are two options for what remains. I can connect this one to the opposite, and then on each side I have only one option, so 1 times 1. Or I can connect this one to its neighbor on the right, and then I have a remaining thing with 4 things, so 2 options. So 2 plus 1 plus 2 is equal to 5. Okay? Now let's do the case of 4. So the case of 4, So now I have 8 points. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And again, my options are to here or to here or to here or to here or to here. Okay, if I go here, I have 6 points left here. Oops, no, wait, did I overdo it? No, I'm fine. If I go here, yeah, I did overdo it, sorry. This option does not exist. I have to leave an even number of points. I cannot connect to here. I cannot connect to here because this would give me an odd number of points here, and there are no possible connections. So, okay, here I have 5 possibilities to complete the picture because this is just an element of TL6. Here I have 2 points here, so 1 option, and 4 points here, so 2 options. Here I have, oh no, this one I've eliminated. Here I have 1 and 2, and here I have 5 and 1. So 5 times 1 is 5, so 5 plus 2 plus 2 plus 5 is 14, so the overall answer is 14. Now I know why I left this space. And you can keep going this way, and surely you recognize this sequence. Do you?
Well, it's something recursive we just recognized.
Right.
Sort of,
but the Catalan numbers. And in fact, if you've seen a derivation of the Catalan numbers, it's often derived by the same recursive procedure. So this is equal to Cn, namely Catalan of n, which is equal to 1 over n plus 1, 2n choose n by some argument that's complicated, and I do remember what it is, but it doesn't matter. And what I really care is the asymptotic behavior. The asymptotic behavior is 4 to the n. 4 to the n sounds like much. But, in fact, if you take a random planar curve and cut it in the middle, so roughly you can estimate that that the length of the intersection will be square root of the complexity of the curve. So basically, and this is not a theorem. It's a sort of experimental observation. So if you draw a planar curve with with complexity n, and you cut it in the middle, it will cut through a line roughly square root of n times. What's the
Cheeger constant?
I'm not sure. What's the rationale? What's the rationale for that? I'm not sure. I mean, I am sure in different contexts. But the way I stated it, right? I'm right now. Let's just leave it as an observable fact. Okay. So really, this square root. So this n is really. So the dimension of the thing you get at the top is 4 to the square root of n, and the dimension of the thing that you get at the bottom is again 4 to the square root of n. And then the cost of pairing them will be roughly their size. Which is again 4 to the square root of n. So C is much less than than 2 to the 30. Okay, the cost is much less than the original difficulty we had. Okay, so that seems to work. That may work. Okay, now let me make it a little bit better, or maybe not quite a little bit better, but a little bit more practical. So the way we will actually do it is as follows. So suppose we have a complicated knot. So again, the crossings have a... I'm just not bothering to mark which crossing is over and under. Instead of cutting it in half, what I'm going to do is I'll have a red line and declare that everything below the red line is already computed and everything above the red line is to be computed. Okay? And I'll slowly move the red line upwards. And then, how will I move it? So, well, I'll move it past the first crossing. And then, in order to move it past the first crossing, I have to take whatever I had below and multiply it by one crossing. And then simplify. And then I'll move it past the second crossing, and so on, until I'm at the top. At each step, so I have n such steps, and at each step, before the step, I have a linear combination of elements of the temporally Lie algebra of whatever happens below the red line. So a linear combination of things like this, and on that step, on the next step, I'm adding one more crossing, so I'm adding a thing like this, and it becomes an element of the temporally Lie algebra of a bigger temporally Lie algebra. And how do you add this element? You really add either a smoothing going this way or a smoothing going the other way, and you simplify. So, two observations. First of all, it makes sense to add at each time the element which increases the length of this red line by the minimal amount. So in other words, it makes sense. So here I've added an element that I've added a crossing that touches the boundary only once. But if I had added a crossing that touches the boundary twice, like this one, then I would have increased the size of the red line by less. In fact, I wouldn't have changed the size of the red line. So, and since my complexity comes from the size of the temporally Lie algebra, I want to each time add the crossing which connects with what I already have the most number of times. And then, to add a crossing, basically you take the element of the temporally Lie algebra, you make two copies of it, one copy you pair with this, the other copy you pair with, well, the other thing, and in both cases you simplify. And what does simplify mean? First of all, you contract curves, and secondly, if a circle got created, you replace it by Q plus Q inverse. The complexity is, so basically it's n steps, and at each step, you do something which is roughly as complex as the size of the maximal temporally Lie algebra that you've seen. So the rank of the temporally Lie of W, where W is the worst size, the worst length of the of red lines that you've seen throughout. So W is the so-called width of the knot K, which is roughly the square root of the number of crossings. So the overall complexity is roughly, N times 4 to the square root of n. The n is negligible, so it's really an exponential in the square root of the size of the knot. which is a lot better than, you know, this is a lot less than 2 to the n. So let's implement it. So, okay. So, where am I? Okay, here. So let's just follow this program. So, fast jumps of a node k is a module in which there is a to-do list. The to-do list is just the original PD diagram converted into a list. Okay, so it's just the list of crossings that I still have to process. And then touched is the list of indices that appear, that I've already touched, that I've already processed. So basically, the list of indices that appear below the red line. Okay? So touched starts as empty. And X is just a name for a crossing that I will use. And J is what I have below the red line, and it starts as 1, nothing. And then, so first I set the to-do list to be everything. And then, while the length of the to-do list is greater than 0, so long as I still have something to do, I find within the to-do list the maximal element, and it's maximal by, so for each element, I compute the length of the intersection of the touched things with that element converted to a list. So basically, I look on all the crossings that are still in the to-do list, and for each one, I find which one has the biggest intersection with the stuff that's already processed. So the next one to be processed is likely to going to be something near the edge of the computation front and not far from it. So this fixes the crossing X, and then I do, let's take J and replace it by, well, and multiply, star equals means multiply it by, so multiply it by X with, if the crossing was positive, replace it by the usual thing, and if the crossing was negative, replace it by the other usual thing. So now J has, more this stuff added to it, and I still need to simplify. So I expand and I contract paths, so if a path goes from A to B and then from B to C, I replace it by a path from A to C. And then whenever I have a cycle, I replace it by the value of a cycle, and that's my new J. And I remove from the to-do list the crossing I've just processed, and that's the end of the while. And then I simplify the rest. So at this point, J is computed, and then I just simplify the result. So again, the program is completely straightforward. So let's enter it, and let's compute it for 3-1, gets the same answer. And now, let me, the same thing that I did before. I'm computing fast jumps of K and comparing it with the built-in answer for all nodes with up to 10 crossings. Before, it took 50-something seconds. So let's see how long it takes now. It still takes some time. 8 seconds. That's better. Okay? So, and it's still a list of truths. And then, just for fun, I really wanted to test if the program is better. Okay? So I wanted a note that have many more crossings. And the easiest way to produce knots with many knots with many crossings is to use torus knots. So if you don't know what torus knots, here is what they are. Do you know? Should I explain? So, what? Should I? It's I fair to say, no, but I'm...
Okay.
So torus knots are so what's a torus knot? I think my rules are that I need to take a picture now. Sorry. So by the way, I mean, So here are several ways to view torus knots. So, well, a torus knot is a knot that you can draw on the surface of a torus. Not too surprising. So, what can you do on the surface? So here is a torus. And now all I want is to draw a knot on that surface. So basically I start somewhere and then I go around this way a number of times while at the same time going around the other way a number of times. So the number of times I go around this way I call P, and the number of times I spin around the other way I call, so the number of times I go around that way I call Q. This is Q and this is P. Just comparing with the pictures I have over there. So, here is the 3-2 torus knot. It's a bit hard to see the torus. It's a bit easier to see the torus if the numbers are larger. So, here is the God knows what 2 torus knot. So this is P is equal to, Q is equal to a very large number. No, P is equal to a very large number because I spin around that way many, many times, and Q is a relatively small number. If you count how many times you go around this time, this way, you'll find that it's 2. Okay? That's all the intermediate cases. So, a different way to realize the same thing. So alternatively, I could start with a torus presented as, a square with n's identified, meaning as R2 modulo Z2, and then take a curve of slope P over Q over here, and then the curve will disappear at the top, reappear at the bottom, continue here, disappear at the top, reappear here, disappear at the top, continue to here, disappear here, reappear here, and so on. And you can check that it will go in one direction P times, in the other direction Q times. A different way to view it is to say, let's look at it in this model. So you look at the point PQ here, connected by a line to the origin, and map it, so this is in R2, and map it and project it to R2 mod Z2. If P and Q are relatively prime, then there are no integer points along this line, so you never come back to where you started. The image on the torus is, and so it's injective to the torus, and so it's a knot in R3. And one last way to view it is to do the following. So you start with Q strands, and you let one of them, basically you make a 1 over Q rotation. So you make one, the last one becomes the first, by having it cross all others, each one once. I'm having trouble drawing it. Okay? So you do this, you look at this basic thing, and you repeat this unit P times, and then you can check, well, at the end you get some long kind of tangle, and then you just close this tangle. you connect top to bottom, and the result is exactly that. So in particular, what's the number of crossings? So what's n? So you have p times, for each step you need q minus 1 crossings, so q minus 1. So for example, if you look at the torus knot 817, the number of crossings in it, sorry, 87, the number of crossings in it is 8 times 6, so that's 48. Okay? Good. So, by the way, here is another picture projected from above. Maybe it's a bit clearer. And finally, fortunately for me, the program I'm using has a built-in generation of torus knots. So the list, so torus knots of n returns the list of all torus knots with up to n crossings. So in particular, torus knots of 100 produces, well, the 3-2 torus knot, which is actually the trefoil, then the 5-2, then the 7-2. This is in order of increasing complexity, up down to the torus knot 53. That actually has 100 crossings, and it's the one. Well, I mean, you go around one way 50 times and the other way 3 times. Okay. And okay, so now I got ambitious, and maybe I'll tell you what my ambition was after I'll start executing it. So let me start executing it. And the ambition was, well, Mathematica has some facility to run things in parallel, so I just wanted to run two computations in parallel. One is the ordinary Jones, and the other is the fast Jones, the two programs, okay? So there is some machinery that you have to launch two kernels and run the two programs on the two kernels. You have to distribute the definition, so make all the definitions accessible to both kernels, and then you and it produces some error messages for reasons I don't understand, but they turn out to be irrelevant. And then I parallel submit, so basically I run two computations at the same time. One is, it actually started computing, so one is, oh damn it, it's, you know, maybe I should have, maybe I'll stop this. Yeah, so I pause the computation, and so one computation is for all k in torus knot up to 100, compute Jones of that torus knot, compute how much time it takes. This is the time is said to be t1, the output is said to be j1, and then print slow Jones for the knot k, the length of the pd of k, so that's just the number of crossings, the time used from the beginning of the computation, the time used for this particular knot, and the value. And then the same thing again on a second kernel, but now using fast Jones instead of Jones. Okay? So let's start running it. So I'll rerun it. I've run it once already, but let me rerun it. And it starts very quickly. And let's see where, this is where the computation is now, but it keeps running. It keeps running. But let's see where we are. Oops, it's a bit hard to see where we are because it keeps moving. But fast Jones is now doing a knot with 47 crossings. It already reached torus knots with 47 crossings. Slow Jones just now outputted something, and it's something with 14 crossings. And if we wait a little bit more, fast Jones will output its next thing. In fact, its next thing will take a while because we stopped just at 47, and the next thing is 48, and 48 is 87, and 87 is a very wide knot. So since it's wide, the computation takes a long time. Oh, but it's done. So so now fast not fast Jones got to 53 and is stuck at 54 because 54 is what? I don't know, but some nice. Large number nice. Times another large number. What?
9 and 7 or something.
9, 7 probably, yeah. Yeah. But it will continue. It will but where is slow Jones? So slow Jones or the basic Jones is now at 15. Okay? So maybe I'll stop this. I'll stop it, save it, and show you that in the 2 hours before class began, I actually ran it all the way to 100, or not all the way to 100, until I ran out of time. And when I ran out of time, I don't know if you can see, maybe I'll increase the font size, but when I ran out of time, Fast Jones got to a knot with 94 crossings, which would take 2 to the 94 time for Slow Jones, which means infinity. And Slow Jones, where's the last output from Slow Jones? Here, it got to 20. So 20 relative to 94, so basically the fast algorithm runs circles around the slow algorithm. Okay? Questions, comments? Okay. So, by the way, I mean, one extra motivation I had for giving this class was to teaching some Mathematica. So, in the first class, I was more careful about it. I actually slowly went through how the program was, how the things were implemented. You should tell me if I should do it now, too. Okay? Anyway, let me take one more, two more pictures and move on. Okay. So this ends what I wanted to say about the Jones polynomial. But there are other things but here's something else I want to say. So okay, first of all, part of the goal of this class is to, or the main goal of this class is to produce some knot invariants that can be computed in polynomial time. So, you know, 4 to the square root of n is not too bad, but it's still much, much bigger than n to the 5 or n to the 6. So my goal is to be able to do something in time n to the 5, okay, or n to the 6 or some polynomial. It's going to be much harder than the Jones polynomial. The Jones polynomial, including implementation, is 1 hour, 2 hours. But this is going to be much harder, but it will be much faster. But before that, a few more words about why I care about knot invariants. So, well, one reason is to separate knots. So, a guy, Vincent, sends you a knot with 200 crossings and you want to decide if it's equal to a knot that a guy, somebody else, or a girl, sends you. You have to be able to, or you have, well, one part of this would be to compute something really, really quickly. Okay, so that's one answer. But there are other things that one might want to know about knots. So I want to tell you about several of these. Okay? So one thing is, the first of these is the genus of a knot. So it's a let me explain what it is. So let me give, maybe I'll start by an example. So let me make a nice, here is an amusing drawing of the trefoil knot. You draw three crossings like this, you connect them, and then you connect on the outside. This is the trefoil, you can check it. It's also the torus knot 3-2, quite clearly. Put a two-dimensional surface whose boundary is this picture. So basically put a disc on the left, a disc on the left, a disc on the right, and connect, so for each of these kind of crossings, connect the two discs by a twisted band. Okay? This is, well, it's sort of like how you construct a Mobius band, except it's not a Mobius band. This is an orientable surface. This surface is orientable. Why? Because, well, basically pick a point. If you want to go to walk around the surface and come back to this point, you'll be crossing an even number of bridges. Each one twists you, but twisting an even number of times gets you back to the same side of the surface. So, you know, if you start on the top here, you'll get to the bottom here, but after coming back here, you'll be again on the top side of the surface. So this is an orientable surface. It's an orientable surface abstractly. Okay, abstractly it's an orientable surface that has one boundary component. Right? Just the boundary is just the knot itself. Okay? So this is a two-dimensional surface with one boundary component. So it must be a genus G surface for some G. It must be sigma G minus, well, I mean, since it has one boundary component, minus a disk, minus a D2 for some G. What is G? Okay? So in other words, what genus surface did I write here? Okay, so you can struggle, you can deform it in your mind, it's very complicated. You can succeed. I've done it. Okay? I know how to do it. Okay? Alternatively, you can compute Euler characteristic. So basically, this is a union of two, well, it's very easy to triangulate it. For example, I can add an edge here, an edge here, an edge here, and then I have a disc on the left, a disc on the right, so E is equal to 2, sorry, V minus E plus F, F is equal, so the Euler characteristic is V minus E plus F, F is equal to 2. Now I have to count how many edges are in this picture, and that's a bit messy. It's these edges plus the edges of the original boundary, and then I have to count the vertices, but you know, I don't really know how to do it, but at the end you can compute the genus, or maybe I do know, but it doesn't matter because it's not hard. And it turns out to be 1. Now, 1 is the minimal genus that of a surface whose boundary is the trefoil knot. Because, well, the only number less than 1 is 0, and if the trefoil knot, so if K was the boundary of a genus 0 surface, meaning S2 minus a D2, meaning a D2, so if the any knot which is a boundary, which can be presented as the boundary of a non-self-intersecting D2, is just an R-naught, right? If you can present your knot as the boundary of a disk, non-self-intersecting disk, then it's the R-naught. So then K is just the R-naught. So definition, the genus of a knot K is the minimal genus of an embedded once punctured a 2D orientable surface whose boundary is K. So then my challenge would be compute that number. So given a knot, figure out what is the smallest genus of a surface whose boundary is that knot. So before that, theorem, that number is well defined. Namely, every knot is the boundary of some surface. Every knot has a genus. And I think I'm out of time, so I'll stop here. Okay? So on Friday, I'll continue with the brute direction of reaching the invariants as quickly as possible. And then on Tuesday, I will again go to the introductory direction.